My dearest friends, allow me to welcome you to today's sermon. When we crane our necks and look out into the void of space, we will find planets of all shapes and sizes, replete with a myriad of strange or mysterious features unique to their own rocky home. But there is a limit to what may be achieved for a world which must abide by the very laws of physics which command our own realm of reality. However, as we all know, there is a plane of existence which stands beyond our own. And here, there is truly no limit as to how a world may be formed. I am, of course, referring to the nightmarish hellscape of the warp, in which the very emotional energies of the sentient species of the galaxy have coalesced to create an infernal dimension of pain. Whilst it may be seen as an impossibility to map or traverse this realm, there are some regions of space where the barriers between reality and of the warp have broken down, with the most notable of these being known as the Eye of Terror. Here, in this cataclysmic warp storm, the chaotic legions of the heretic Astartes have laid claim to forlorn planets, pledging to reform them into new fortresses which could outshine their old homeworlds, which were purged long ago in the aftermath of the Horus heresy. With the emergent powers of the fallen Primarchs, these terrible figures have been granted with the ability to shape their new home into whatever fashion they desire. And it is from this that we will tell the following story. This is a tale of an expedition taken by a heretic Death Guard siege master named as Vorx, who returns home to the detestable plague planet, which now exists as a temple of decay, ruled over by none other than the demon Primarch Mortarion. Our fetid captain, having been departed for years on a mission of bringing death to the territories of the Imperium, now once again walks upon the virulent soils of this world before returning to his personal dwellings to recount his vile actions taken within real space. But without further ado, let us look to the pestilent world of plague and learn of its noxious environment. From the void, the world of Eleothada looks beautiful, but no one calls it that anymore. Almost no one in the galaxy even remembers the name, save for that warp-storm-tossed remnant of a race who used to own it, and they never come here. The word means sublime soul garden in a tongue that was once spoken the length and breadth of known space. Vorx considers that as he sits back in the lander. Like all vehicles of his legion, it is a bastardized version of a standard Imperial design, yet this one is heavy, pocked, and disgustingly battle-worn. Mucus slithers down the interior of the viewport. Centipedes writhe in the corners of the chamber, their backs palpitating with a blotch of lurid coloration. Vorx is one of the few left that knows the name of this planet and what it meant to those who christened it. All planets in the Eye of Terror have names given them by the Eldar. The words are figurative and allegorical, twisting with the many meanings that are only possible in that treacherous Xeno's tongue. Eleothada does mean sublime soul garden, but it also means prideful wasteland, and also dry valley of dreams. Vorx admires the way a single word can have so many interpretations. When he was in his mortal youth, he hated Xenos with a passion driven by his training and his bioengineering, and would not have appreciated the subtlety. Now that so many centuries have passed, and he has become so much less ignorant, he finds that he no longer hates anything very much. That is one of the gifts of the god he knows. He does not know, however, why Mortarion chose this place to make his own. Perhaps the Primarch desired something pure to corrupt. Or perhaps he liked the name, harking back, as it does to the greater garden, the one true garden, and saw some kind of fateful resonance there. From orbit, it is green, as verdant now as old Terra must have been at the dawn of time. It is an emerald in the void, spinning slowly amid a sky of violet and vermilion. Every color on the face of the world is ramped up, distilled, and intensified. Some of its colors do not exist in the purely physical universe at all, and have names only the demons can pronounce. From a distance, Eleothara shines like a lantern in the dark. Nor does Vaux know why Mortarion never renamed it. The Primarch, it is true, has an exaggerated interest in names, bordering on obsession. Since the great shame of the flight from Terra, in which the entire Legion was harried and humiliated and nearly broken apart, that obsession has only grown. It was said that even during the Crusade, before the Primarch obtained his demonhood and became something little less than a god himself, those relentless superstitions were already making their presence felt. That was in the days before the Destroyer Hive, of course, while the Death Guard still resisted becoming what they were always destined to be. Now that they are on the other side of that transition, like moths squirming out of the chrysalis, it is interesting to see how much has been retained. So the world was never renamed. Those who were driven there in ignominy barely referred to it at all, thinking their retreat would be temporary. Even when that dream faded and the manse began to grow and stretch out permanent roots, they never reached for some Barbaran label or other to give a sense of solidity to their endeavor. It was left to others to call it the Plague Planet, mostly in mockery or fear. The hateful Thousand Suns, those arrogant and deluded tricksters, were the probable origin, for they had carried over their ancestral distaste of all things earthy and honest. Vaux despises the Thousand Suns more than he despises any citizen of the Imperium. In fact, he reserves mostly affection for the remaining defenders of Terra, seeing them as ignorant and waiting for salvation. But he cannot forgive the sins of Magnus's progeny, for they should have known what they were doing. Even in their folly and destruction, they have persisted in being a legion of, as Garstag puts it, arrogant, shit-stained bastards. Still, in all likelihood, it was they that coined the name, which the planet's new residents eventually took up themselves, in a kind of defiance. The Plague Planet. It has remained ever since, even in the annals of the Imperial Inquisition, who speculate on what such a world must be like from the scraps and snippets they glean here and there. Vaux smiles. They can have no idea. It is Vaux's belief that there are only a dozen, perhaps two dozen planets in the galaxy truly worth a damn. Terra, incomparable Terra, bauble of every war that humanity has ever fought, is one of them. Mars is close behind. Barbarous most assuredly wasn't, and it's very much for the best that it's been consigned to ashes. Soon the list gets harder to add to until you get to the Plague Planet. Now then, here is a rock a warrior could die for. The lander plunges down to cloud level, and Vaux sees the familiar patterns of glow and diffusion. The entire globe is swathed in that humid cover, constantly changing, morphing, discharging, and replenishing. The lander penetrates the outer level, and for a few moments the descent becomes rocky. Vaux relaxes, knowing that the transition is brief. Mortarion has generated those clouds to keep his realm shrouded from the rest of the eye. The Primarch ensures that they remain unbroken, lit from below by the exercise of his forges and his devilish manufactoria. Those clouds are the most profound poison, concentrated toxicity, capable of dissolving entire starships if the whim of the god directs it, and only the Legion's own transports traverse it unscathed. The lander breaks through, and the hidden surface of the world below slides into view. When the Death Guard first arrived here, it was a formless sphere, studded with eldritch ruins and haunted by the thin voices of Xenos ghosts. The ghosts are gone now, for that species of indulgent semi-death is not tolerated in this place of dark fecundity. In its place, mountains have been raised. They are not natural. Their sides, glistening with cultivated slimes, are too steep, too dark, to have been formed by tectonics or erosion. They are pillars of extravagance, thrust up from alien soil by spine-bending labor and the injunctions of sorcery. Over 10,000 years, the pinnacles have pushed higher and steeper, crowding up against one another until the entire planet's crust resembles a giant porcupine skin. The valleys glowing with vivid green fire, the peaks as black as the souls of their creators. Every inch of ground below is riddled with the tunnels of an immeasurably vast army, once baseline human, now a variety of subspecies, steadily ground down and remade into the image of beasts. They drudge in the toxin-thick chasms, hauling raw materials for new spires of filth, sustained only by remorseless faith and the raw flesh of their own dead. They suck in spore-rich air, making their mutations gradually more flamboyant, and tread the old roads with packs on their misshapen backs. As the galaxy ages, those tracks have been worn away ever deeper, driving further into the crust of the world, even as the cliffs above them pile higher. Atop each of those cliffs stand great fortresses, the least of them a rival for the greatest fastnesses of the Imperium. Green aurorae flicker across parapets of black iron, briefly exposing the steep angled profile of giant artillery ranks. Demon engines prowl the ramparts, their exhausts gouting black slurry. Immense shroud creatures swim in the sulphurous heavens, trailing long cloaks riddled with mold. Rib-thin campaniles toll endlessly in discordant monotony, their dull iron-cast bells hammered by teams of bestials to mark the creation of fresh joys and miseries. Deep down, buried within the world's unquiet mantle, are the fabled networks of laboratories, apothecarians, fermentation chambers, brew cauldrons, and rot pits. They merge into one another, blending into a twilight world of steam and toil, so that not one living soul, perhaps not even the Death Lord himself, knows their full extent. Spiraling chimneys vomit smoke every hour, adding to the inky, gravid clouds that swim across the bio-industrial landscape. Rain falls in thick torrents, cascading down the steep fortress sides and washing filth back down to the base of the chasms. Bacteria burst and divide in those cataracts, breeding voraciously in the humid depths before flowering in new and esoteric forms once the dim green sunlight filters back through the murk. Vaux casts his jaded eyes across the vista and feels his old soul rejoice. The plague planet is the lodestone of his people, the crucible in which their blessed gifts are developed. They inherited a dust-dry morgue and turned it into a vista of magnificence. This is a vindication of their esoteric creed, of the belief that through entropy comes apotheosis, of the wholehearted embrace of mortality in all its truest and most honest aspects. The lander is shaking down, buffeted by moisture-heavy winds. The far horizon is lit by sooty pyres, and Vaux sees a mighty demon ship rise up slowly from a cradle of rusting spines. Even within the controlled atmosphere of the lander, he can taste the many and wonderful pheromones that only exist here. He hears the boom and roll of drums, the braying of indentured herds, the background drone of a quadrillion flies, all directed towards one glorious end: evangelism. This place is the Mother Church, the incubator for every bio-creed and flesh catechism, the pregnant source, the fertile seed. It is all for dissemination elsewhere. The Legion will only rest when all planets are plague planets and the bells toll out across a galaxy made into this image of spectacular decay. They are the willing disciples, cast adrift in a cold and insipid universe. For a long time they have been working alone, driven onwards only by internal commitment and orders so old they could have been ossified before the age of the doomed War Master. There was no word from the Primarch himself, who was said to spend his days in his mouldering scriptorium. The Legion held together during that time, although it has frayed at the edges, some tempted to cleave their own path, others drawn by the siren call of the Despoiler. That was always a regret to Vaux, who has not heard the voice of his Primarch for many centuries. But there is change in the air now. The plagues taste a little different. The chime of the bells has a strange timbre. Even the bestials sense it, and they lift their elongated faces to the seamy heights. The lander reaches its destination. A raised scaffold draped with black vines, half hidden behind the miasma of forge smoke. Waiting around the receiving platform's perimeter are a variegated collection of the plague planet's denizens, bestials wearing corroded metal plates and long rags, priests of the god in threadbare robes, several carrying great bells dangling atop heavy staffs. One of them, by his stature, is clearly unbroken, but he does not wear his armor. His fleshy, mold-black body is barely contained by iron thread mail. His sallow head, riddled with blotches that indicate some blood contagion, pokes stalk-like from a moth-eaten fur mantle. His eyes bleed softly with pale green light, and when he opens his tooth-spare mouth, the same light spills from between gray gums. He leans on a knotted length of wood, itself made seemingly fragile by the gnawed tunnels of borers, but which has somehow endured for as long as the war has. Not everyone knows the name of that staff either. Vaux, who studies all such things, knows that it is Wyrmwold, the last sliver of living matter taken from Barbarus and invested with all that world's spite and futility. Everything else was destroyed, but this final splinter is still clutched tight in claw-like hands. It is a relic. The reasons for keeping it beyond sentiment are unclear. Vaux descends the ramp and bows before the staff bearer. "Sliver Gristle," he says reverently. Sliver Gristle is a curiosity. He was once Kriegar, a plague marine who fought in the Great Crusade. Like the rest of them, he endured the defeat under Terra's vertiginous battlements and fought all the way back to the shameful Eye. Unlike most, he did not remain locked in that prison, but found some means to slip out before the bounds were fully set. He traveled to Barbarus, where he managed to retrieve Wyrmwold before the virus bombs fell. Then something changed in him. He traveled strange paths, some say beyond the halo stars and into the deepest dark. And when he returned, he told even stranger stories. His speech had become as warped as his body, and it was reported that pacts had been made in the demonic choirs to consume his essence as the result of an unspecified slight or prideful action. That was never proven, not even by the greatest priests of the god, but something had definitely taken place, for Sliver Gristle cast off his armor, took up the threadbare cloak of a pilgrim, and never left the plague planet again. I am an eater of the Neverborn, he told any who asked. That too is unproven, and yet Vorks believes it. He believes that Slivergristle has been possessed more than once, but that his argue-shot body treats trapped intelligences as one more infection among the hundreds of others, and is thus able to dissolve them. Vorks further speculates that the youngest and most foolish of the demonic choir see this as a challenge, and jostle for access to this most eccentric of hosts, hoping to master him and claim his soul. One by one, they have all been digested, leading to little more than corpuscent-lit halitosis. Such are the stories told of Slivergristle. Whether they have any basis in truth is doubtful, though his favor rides high among the many competing vicars of the plague planet. Siege master, says Slivergristle, as wisps of ghost light snag at the corners of his mouth. Home to welcome. Travels good. They were. Vorks's warband, the Lords of Silence, have been enjoying the favor of the god. The Imperium is becoming less able to prevent their sallies from the slowly breaking jail of the Eye, and so they have feasted on worlds. The reaping continues, he says, in a polite formula. They walk together towards the platform's edge. In the distant darkness, Vorks can hear lowing from the ritual abattoirs. He smells the richness of the moat-riddled air. He sees the green-tinged aurorae ripple across the jagged skyscape of spoil spires.
Aware you indeed the tidings of, yes? Asks Slivergristle.
I have heard things, says Vorks, here and there.
True. Of it all, true and in that.
Slivergristle belches, and a puff of short-lived flame whispers in the darkness. So skeptical, no, I would not so listen. Called back in a reason, yes, lives he.
I know the Primarch lives, Brother Vicar, says Vorks. No, lives he. Blood now boiling, just old like again.
These rumors were known about. Word had passed across Warbens like the diseases they reveled in, somehow leaping across the immense gulf of the void to be half heard and copied and doubted. That was, after all, why Vorks had come back. There were 1,000 reasons for daring the treacherous shoals of the Eye's borders again, not least the close pursuit of more than one chapter of the Adeptus Astartes, but that was the choicest of all, that he might be roused again from introspection.
I'd believe you more, Vorks says, were I to see it with my own eyes. Slivergristle grins. Why, you are thinking back here in this now, of course. He knows all it of and watches, now moves, heh, after so long.
They approach an archway. The lintel is of brass and has the figurehead of a bloated face made in scorched metal. It is hot on the plague planet, a world lit by the off-draft of furnace towers and the humid warmth of culture pools. Vorks pauses. I have not spoken with him for a long time. Slivergristle nods. You shall wait here, not much more. Why are you here in truth? Again. There is more than one reason. For respite, for recovery, to take counsel from Philemon, whom he wishes to take with him into Solace's bounds, to escape the weary competitions within the warband just for a time, and yes, to dare the passage of the manse. All these things are true. This is home, brother, Vorks says. Slivergristle laughs and nods. For now. He grins. For now, but come change it will, oh yes. First he goes to his own holdings. They are high on a ridge, like all the domains of the Unbroken, peering over the lips of precipices down into the fog-choked valleys below.
That is an affectation they all adopt, taken from the distant past. Once, they were not permitted to ascend into the heights. Now they dwell there exclusively, adopting the manner of those who once oppressed them, even those who came afterwards, like Dragon, who have no memory of Barbarus, even they adopt the custom. He walks old paths, treading on lichen-sponged stone. His passage is mobbed by herds of bestials, some of whom try to touch him, others who clear the path for him. They light lanterns, and butter-yellow light spills from panels of thick, liquid glass. From time to time, he spies members of his order lumbering through dark fields with scythes in hand. Some salute grimly, in the old crusade fashion. Others stare at him mutely, their soft lenses refracting in the ever-murk, and he wonders if they have lost their minds at last. It always happens sooner or later in this place. It is always night on the plague planet. No dawn sun pierces its shifting clouds, and the only constant illumination comes from below, from the phosphorescent mists and the bioluminescent fungi. Every figure is a shadow, silhouetted against that warm emerald light. Even the demons, the greatest of which loom like bloated mountains against fiery cauldrons of soul fire. He reaches his domain, which has been called Hope's Revenant ever since he raised it. He remembers delving into the black soils with his own hands, back when the land was bare and the skies were lit with Zeno's wails. He remembers raising the walls above the crags, mining the soft stone and cutting it down. He remembers the scaffolds and the work gangs, and the endless slaves brought from raids into real space to end their days in exhaustion and decrepitude. Now he looks at the high walls as black as oil, the parapets lit with that ever-present soft glow. He smells the demons slithering within, the little lords and the plague bearers who can ghost between the stones like gas. He breathes in and smells his house plagues, the ones unique to this plot, rotting slowly in the oubliettes. For the first time in a long while, Vaux is satisfied. Occasionally, he thinks of another life for himself, one confined to Hope's Revenant, where he remains closeted with the books of numerology and the gardens, free to contemplate the truth and explore its mysteries. He has never given into it, but believes that the entire Legion shares this morose tendency. The greatest of them, after all, has been indulging it for 10,000 years. He passes under the high portcullis, and those bestials blessed with elongated necks bow to him. He processes across the inner courtyard, where his steward, Loam, waits dutifully. Loam is a bestial, with a long equine face and buck teeth. His brown hide is wrinkled almost into oblivion and glistens from perspiration. "Welcome, Siege Master," Loam says. The steward always uses the proper titles. Unlike most bestials, he can talk, although the sounds are crude, and he will never be eloquent. "How stands the citadel?" asks Vaux, looking up at the inner walls. They are streaked with moisture, dripping slowly. Flayed corpses bump and swing from one high tower, picked at by carrion crows. From somewhere far down below, he can hear the bubble of boil vats and smell the cooking from the refectories. "Rots," says Loam, "topples. You should come home more." Vaux smiles and keeps walking. "I wish I could," he says, reaching the great doors to his private apartments. Once within, he climbs the interior stairs, treading paths that he built himself. Every worn stone is familiar, every smell is comforting. Once he would have scorned such notions, having been made immune to all calls of family or community. Now he values these things. He tends to his herds and his slaves, seeing what can be made of them and taking pleasure in their successes. After a long climb, he reaches his sanctuary. He takes an iron key from the ring at his belt and unlocks the door. When he pushes it open, a rich swell of old smells tumbles out, ones he has not enjoyed for a long time. He enters a grand chamber perched high at the pinnacle of the tallest tower. Bookcases line the walls, each stuffed with tome upon tome. Most are leather-backed, some bound in human hide, some in stranger coverings. They are mostly ancient, and their age seeps from them like a stink. They are all slowly mouldering away, flaking into nothingness, drooping from the extreme humidity. Worms burrow into them, gnawing trails through thick parchment. Ivory-eyed rats scuttle from stand to stand, hoarding scraps in their pink claws. The floor is knee-deep in discarded vellum. Quills scratch across writing desks, propelled by invisible hands, inscribing endless lists. Some are chronicles of years, others are typologies of phages and contagions, others still are the names of allies and enemies. Vorx glances at one, the vellum rustling as the quill wobbles across its surface. Tophar, Mandravaxon, Yarnhamar. None of those words mean anything to him. They may do in the future, or they may not. It does not pay to listen too closely to the outputs of bound instrumental demons. He pushes his way towards a pulpit at the far end of the chamber. A single book lies open on its inclined surface, untroubled by the attentions of vermin. Its hide is as white as bone, and its pages as thick as a finger. It is impossibly huge, that book. If looked at from certain angles, it seems to go on forever, sinking deep into the library's moldy floor, although from most aspects it is no thicker than the rest of them. He reaches for a metal quill standing in a dusty sleeve and dips it into a well of viscous ink. He holds it over the blank parchment and collects himself. Then he begins to write. Slowly, carefully, he traces out tiny letters in immaculate standard Gothic, of a grammar and idiom commensurate with the early Crusade. The first thing he writes is a name. Brother Sergeant Caius Meldonia, Squad Taxis, 4th Company, the Emperor's Blades. He pauses, remembering the face. Location: Atamar, Outer Reach Spinwood, System Marker, 45-56-3. A faint smile crinkles across his sore, clustered lips. The action had been prosecuted well. We were on the outward march from Kletan. He fills in more details, always in the same manner, not lapsing into Barbaran or Mortei, the debased vernacular of the plague planet, or even current era Gothic. This record was started at the very commencement of his career in the Death Guard and has been continued in the same vein ever since. When he finishes the entry, he carefully adds the date approximation according to both the Terran system and Chronolattis, a scheme of his own devising that maps events to a more fluid set of points underpinned by warp dynamics. It is more accurate, at least from a number of important points of view, although it has peculiarities of its own. Whereas the Imperial system becomes more inaccurate the further one is from Terra, and the further in time one is from the nominal baseline event, Chronolattis works forward to the end of the universe, a constant Vorx names T for Thanatos, and becomes more reliable the closer the apocalypse comes. He takes time to cross-reference the entry with previous ones. He adds the relevant numbers to several interlinked grids, drawing the numerals with exactitude, Once done, he tallies certain esoteric relationships and determines if significant patterns have emerged, then logs them in a third set of ledgers. Then he repeats the process with ammunition loader Sylve Clude, resident of Atomar Orbital Station 4. Less is known about that death, for the stature of the victim was minuscule, but he records all that he has been able to determine, for completeness is a virtue. He has many hours of work ahead. The raiding season has been long, and he has much blood on his hands from it. He labors methodically, giving each entry just as much care as the first ones. The first biographies were written 10,000 years ago. This chronicle, this record of death served at his hand, stretches back to the dawn of the Imperial Age. For all Vorx knows, it may be the most complete history of any kind still intact. Inquisitors would sacrifice entire systems to retrieve it if they only knew of its existence. More than one petty demon has been spun into instantiation, purely as a result of symmetries picked out on the pages. Others of the Neverborn have come to Hope's Revenant and tried to consume the book, believing its contents might elevate them within their crowded and jostling pantheon. But the library is carefully guarded with ether traps and honey pits, and Vorx has designed many subtler defenses to confound them. The book has no title. Or, to be more precise, the book's title is also its contents. The final entry will be his own. Such psychic accumulation of killing generates a final artifact. When Vorx dies, the last page will complete itself, capping the immense and winding account of a soul's extension beyond all mortal tolerance. On that day, the tome will close, turned as if by unseen hands. The symbols will arrange and sift, the numbers will slot into new positions, and its fusion of occult symbology will reach apotheosis. It will be the final legacy of uncountable lives, stored and cross-referenced, counted and totaled, a product of magnificent uselessness. This is Vorx's great act of spite towards impermanence. He is smiling as he writes it, and the passage of time slows, dilates, warms up. He never knows how long it has taken once he stops. When he looks up again, a day might have passed, or a month, or many years. Such is the nature of the labor, and of the world on which it is performed. On this occasion, when the quill is placed back in the sleeve, and the last of the ink dries on the page, he turns to see a figure in his library. Even after so long on this strange planet, with its comings and goings of gods and daemons, its creaks and groans, and its bending of the normal laws, he is taken aback. The place ought to have been secure, and he briefly wonders if his life is in danger. Then he sees who it is and relaxes. The visitor is far more massive than he, a true giant of twisted ceramite and overspilling flesh. He even knows his name, for there are not many of this breed. "You didn't knock, Slaan," Vorx says. The Death Shroud Terminator does not smile, at least not obviously. His face is entirely hidden behind a landslip of helm and cowl and bursting flesh. His armor is a near black green, like pond slime, and his ragged scraps of cloak and chasuble are a dirty gray. He breathes like an animal breathes, and his enormous slumped chest heaves with every intake. The god has been generous to him, gifting him innumerable alterations, blights, and contusions. His long man-reaper scythe is warped and curving, more like a coil of rope than a length of adamantium, but it is all the deadlier for that. Slaan has been there from the start, too. He has seen the cold valleys of Barbarus and huddled in that world's freezing nights. He knows, just as Vorx does, how much better things have got. "He is ready," Slaan hisses, a dry whisper through old vocal cords. Vorx prepares himself. so soon. You have been here 8 weeks, says Slaun. That takes Vorks aback. Really?
This is becoming eccentric now, Vorks. Do not rely on his favor forever. You could have done more were it not for...
Slaun does not need to finish that. Vorks can do it for him, were it not for the obsessions, the numbers, the recording, the completion of pointless tasks.
Well, says Vorks, I am ready now.
He'll be extravagantly pleased by that, says Slaun. Come with me.
My friends, this is where I shall end our story. Truly, there are few places within even the hellish Immaterium which can possibly compare with the sheer malignity of Mortarion's malign plague planet. Perhaps the only region which would outshine its septic aura would be of the personal dwelling of Nurgle himself. His impossible gardens of death, pestilence, and plague will never be intruded upon. However, we must remember that his scions do indeed hold lofty ambitions towards creating their own dens of putrescent decay. As it stands today, those who serve Nurgle do in fact seem to be delving more and more into the material realm of our galaxy in order to corrupt our own worlds, all so that they may bring more death and corruption throughout the stars. The apocalyptic conflicts, which have been aptly named as the Plague Wars, are perhaps the most notable of engagements which relate to this goal. The Death Guard, led by Mortarion himself, invaded the realm of Ultramar, with the sole aim of stealing away the prosperous worlds of the Ultramarines, so that they may be incorporated into the great gardens of Nurgle. As we all know, this was ultimately unsuccessful, and the heretics were banished back to the infernal realm of the warp, but it still highlights how the ever-encroaching spread of plague is one which is sadly being propelled by those who have fallen to the sway of the demonkin, and they must be given no mercy wherever they are encountered. This is a tale which we shall explore in more detail at a future date, but for now, I believe that it is time for us to close this chapter on today's story. I thank you all for listening to my retelling in its entirety, and I hope that you all have a pleasant day, bereft of sickness. But for now, I wish you all goodbye.